It's time now to get behind the headlines of this week's Hendersonville Lightning with editor and publisher Bill Moss. Lightning Thursday is brought to you by Fletcher Park Inn, independent Christian retirement community. Fletcher Park Inn, Henderson County's best kept retirement secret.
That's right, Lightning Thursday. Hendersonville Lightning is on the streets and it's in your mailboxes, and it is now on the radio here on this Thursday morning at 6 minutes after eight. Bill Moss, good morning, sir. Happy Lightning Thursday.
Good morning. Happy Lightning Thursday to you as well, and happy to be back in the Lightning saddle.
Yes, we're glad to have you back in the Lightning saddle and the Lightning microphone, good sir. Let's get right to the stories. Let's get right to behind the headlines, Bill. And of course, your big headline right here on the front page today. We've been hearing a lot about this over the last week. Gay Pride Proclamation draws dissent from council members.
Exactly right. Yeah, we kind of start with chapter two, or the other shoe falling on a story that began as they tend to begin with the Lightning first reporting on about mid-afternoon Thursday, even before the city council convened, that there was a lot of interest, shall we say, on either side of this. At that point, proposed on the agenda of the city council proclamation to declare Hendersonville's first ever Pride Day. Hendersonville Pride Day actually has now been declared, and it will be this coming Saturday, June 15th. Actually, there's a movie night going on. I'm not sure the location of that on Friday night, and then there's a picnic at Patton Park, and I think it's called the Atlanta Men's Gay Chorus at the I think First Congregational Church.
That makes sense.
I think they have two performances that are sold out for that. But let's go back to the politics of it and the little bit of an uproar afterwards, and quite the celebration immediately after Mayor Barbara Volk introduced and read in front of a large audience, overfilled the room there at City Ops Center, had to move it to City Ops Center because of the size of the crowd. Both opponents, as we report, seemed to fill about two-thirds of the room, and some opponents of the Gay Pride resolution. Mayor Volk read this proclamation, as we'll get into later. We'll describe, well, was this an act of the city council or just the mayor? She read the proclamation. You know, it just takes a few minutes. There was a strong supporter of it, kind of helped get this rolling, that stood up there with her, and the mayor gave her a copy of the proclamation. And then she, Laura Bannister is her name, Ms. Bannister, and all the many supporters and the opponents, actually, at that point, they all spilled outside onto the street and into the parking lot there of the City Ops Center. The supporters, they were real proud and happy to have gotten this proclamation of Hendersonville's first Gay Pride Day, or what's actually formally called Hendersonville Pride Day. It doesn't have the word gay in it or LGBT or anything like that. But they all go outside. They have a big celebration, and the opponents are holding signs, and also they're there for a little while, but mostly just huddled among themselves, talking around their vehicles, and then they soon leave. So there you go. There was a proclamation. It said the LGBT community, we welcome them. They're contributors to the community in many ways, in the economy. They worship alongside us, and so forth. And then the reaction to that came a day or two earlier. And as the Lightning reported, after it ended up working a lot of the weekend, contacting all four of the, by the way, male council members who opposed and said that they really opposed the proclamation, were all careful and emphatic to say, we do not oppose the LGBT community, nor the rights of the LGBT community, you know, the rights in the workplace, and even the rights to have these, to have a Pride Day and have a celebration. But they opposed the city's official imprimatur, I guess you might say, on the Pride Day, and said, and they were careful to explain, and we devoted a lot of words, about 1,400, I think it was, to their explanation of the difference between a proclamation and a resolution. A resolution is introduced and usually read and like a proclamation is, but then, big difference here, voted on by the city council. Proclamation is a mayoral in the city of Hendersonville. It is a mayoral proclamation. There's many of them. There was even another one that night that was a proclamation honoring D-Day, memorializing D-Day and the men who served and sacrificed and gave all, we say, on that day, June 6th. 1944. And there's many, many others. As Mayor in the interview with the Lightning said, I've done them for 100th birthdays. I've done them for every civic organization in town. We've done them for to fight diseases and many, many other things. So they are pretty routine. But council member says, no, we really weren't for this. And we wanted, we the council members wanted it known that they were not for it.
So were they blindsided at the meeting itself by this, or did they know about it beforehand?
That is a good question, and the answer is a little bit blindsided, but not in the moment. I think the first recognition that we report in the Lightning was in an interview with Steve Carricker, who said, I first heard about it a couple weeks ago. So it was not brand new.
Okay.
It's when I walked into City Hall and the city clerk mentioned it when I was picking up my mail. The others, and then the one council member that we know from interviews that really tried to intervene with Mayor Volk and say, I'm not for this, sort of, let's not do it, or why are you doing it? And so that took place. I think it was in emails. I'm not sure if there was personal contact or phone calls. That took place in the days before the city council meeting. The other two members, I'm sure, knew about it in advance, but whether Jeff Miller and Jerry Smith tried, I'm pretty sure they didn't speak with Mayor Volk about it. And a couple of them said, she doesn't really communicate with us that much about these things. They're on the agenda, and, you know, they can talk to her if they want to. But she did not. One of their points was she did nothing back channel or behind the scenes before this came up to try to win their support.
Right.
And it, as we say, it doesn't back city ordinance, it doesn't require their support.
Right. Bottom line, it's a mayoral decision.
It's a mayoral proclamation. Now, step two of that story is that may change now. Because of this, that may change.
Ah.
Jerry Smith says, here's a quote from Ron Stevens saying, we are working on this to get it where she or future mayors can't issue a proclamation without the majority of the city council approving it. And then Jeff Miller says, well, what if other groups what if groups that are unsavory, White Supremacy Day or other days or that are specific groups, what if they come and insist that they want a proclamation? So, as he says, opened up a can of worms. They say they don't want to do controversial. They call it controversial, and they say they don't want to do controversial proclamations.
Sure. All right. It'll be interesting to follow that story. And speaking of the city council, we also learned, I guess it was this week, that Mayor Pro Tem Ron Stevens will not be seeking another term in the council.
That is correct. We do have, I think that would have been a fourth term for Ron Stevens, been on there a while, has run for mayor twice. He is bowing out, but we will have an election. Nevertheless have three candidates, Steve Carricker running for reelection, and two other candidates, Lindsay Simpson and Jennifer Hensley, young moms running for that seat. So I mentioned, of course, we do have four men on there and the mayor. There's a possibility that could change.
Mm-hmm. Let's stay on the front page here before we take our break. Let's talk about the Opportunity House. What's happening over at the Opportunity House? State AG is probing Op House. That's the state attorney general, I'm assuming.
That it is, yeah. That's the state attorney general.
What's going on over there, Bill?
Quite a lot. Less that we actually know about. And that is sort of the crux of, let's go back to before we talked about the state deputy attorney general looking into the Opportunity House. We've got the Community Foundation lawsuit that filed in December of last year after the Community Foundation spent most of 2018 trying to get what the Community Foundation regards as very simple, very basic information. Who are your board members? What are your finances? What are your salaries? May we see minutes? What is your programming that serves the senior community? Or if you serve arts, if you now serve the general public more than just seniors, as you say, in your amended mission statement, what is that programming? We've noticed that you have a lot of tenants that are for-profit companies or businesses. We've heard that you're selling the property. We'd like to know what you plan to do with the proceeds, since we, the Community Foundation, are listed in your charter as the receiver of the assets. Should y'all dissolve and sell your property, or sell your property and dissolve? The Community Foundation, as we learned officially last week and were able to prove and report, the Community Foundation actually just kind of turned this lawsuit over, or sent this lawsuit, which you can do now with a punch of a press of a button on an email attachment, to the state attorney general and said, here's our lawsuit. Please consider it a complaint. And we hope you'll open an investigation into the Opportunity House, because there's lots of, in the view of Community Foundation, fishy things going on there. And there's lots of questions. There's mainly just a stone wall. There's mainly just a blockade, you might say, or a lack of cooperation in turning over any of this information, at least to the Community Foundation. Now that the state attorney general is in the picture, they are being much, much more cooperative, because I think they see the hammer of the attorney general, and they clearly recognize of the attorney general in the way they do not recognize, and they openly say they do not recognize really the power or the right of the Opportunity House to get these documents. They know under the law, there's no disputing that the state attorney general is entitled to ask them for these documents, which things like an IRS 990 form are a public record in any event.
Right.
They have to turn that over.
Right.
And we've gotten those 990 forms ourselves and reported them up through 2017. We still don't have the 2018 990, which, of course, is would have been due and has already been, they say, turned over to the IRS. Unfortunately, under the law, they don't have to turn that over to us and the rest of the public for the 2018 until November 15th of this year.
So I'm curious about this, because I've been driving by, of course, and looking at the Opportunity House over the last couple of years. Has it still been operating as the Opportunity House?
That goes to the heart of the question.
Okay.
That's the question of the Community Foundation. It is now the question of the Attorney General. It has been, as you've seen in our investigative reporting, a question of the Hendersonville Lightning going on now. We had a big, long story that kind of explained all of this, sort of a comprehensive tell-it-whole, as we say, from the beginning of the organization in the late 1950s until today, that asking that same question. We do know, because they now have acknowledged that they have the property for sale, because they've actually said one other element of this long story that explains the conflict and dispute, that they would like to sell the property to raise money, for one thing, to pay these lawyers. So, and to the extent they have any money, probably not much, they need more. They're spending down their limited treasure at this point on defense lawyers.
Wow.
So it's not a good situation in terms of, proper stewardship of whatever limited funds they have. And the limited funds are, at this point, not grants, not membership dues, and not rents from nonprofits, but rents from the tenants, which are for the most part, not nonprofits. Exactly. There is a church which is nonprofit, but it is the church is not carrying out the mission as described in the Opportunity House Charter by any means. It's a church.
For anybody listening to this interview who has moved here in the last 5 years or so, there was a time when that Opportunity House was tremendous. I remember years ago when Lucy Perkey was running it, that place was truly an opportunity house. It was, there were so many people involved and so many members. It was thriving.
Started by, I'm forgetting one of the names, Dr. Gideon's mother. And
yeah.
I'll have to look that up from our previous story in 1950, in a house on Fleming Street.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was in
before
a house.
Before it went to the old A&P building.
Before they moved into the old A&P supermarket.
Uh-huh.
In the 1400 block of Asheville Highway. And you're exactly right. They had literally hundreds of members. We go back to actually, and we report in this story, in fairly recent times, maybe 2000, as I think we said as recently as 07 or 08, about $250,000 in revenue reported as grants and membership dues. But a lot of that was membership dues.
Uh-huh.
There was also rents from various organizations such as Dances. The Card Players were there. The Bridge Players.
The Bridge Club, yeah.
Were there. There was a decent amount of revenue, I think it was, from those tenants. Not as much as they really needed. When that started to fall, when membership started to fall off, they couldn't. They were not making nearly enough in rent from the various nonprofits to make a go of it. The building started to deteriorate, and that's when, in 2016, things, the finances and every other thing, and membership and activity had really fallen off a lot in 2016. When these new leaders of it, Ken Rhodes, the president, and Jackie Roberts, who serves as executive director, came on board, and in their long defense of all this community foundation and state attorney general business, they have argued that Ken Rhodes and the plan of Ken Rhodes was one that the board approve, and that was to try to get revenue the way they are getting revenue. They're just to finish this last. Sorry, it's
yeah,
over,
no, no, no.
Overly long.
No, it's good.
Their point is that if we didn't have this lawsuit to worry about, we'd be a lot more successful.
Right.
But
right.
We'll see about this. This is there are much more to follow on this story, of course.
And of course, the Hendersonville Lightning will be on it. You are listening to Lightning Thursday here on WTZQ.
Fletcher Park Inn is the best kept retirement secret in Henderson County. Make plans now to come for your tour and complimentary lunch at the only Christian independent retirement community in the area that offers a daily lunch buffet with meat and vegetarian and vegan options. Don't miss our summer special. Sign up before Labor Day and your first month is totally free. Come and see our spacious remodeled apartments available now. Call Lisa for details, 209-6935. This is Linda McIntyre, director at Fletcher Park Inn, inviting you to visit today.
Lewis Williams & Sons is the area's largest distributor of mobile home supplies. Whether you need doors, windows, plumbing, or skirting, Lewis Williams & Sons has anything you need for your mobile home. Visit Lewis Williams & Sons in sunny and friendly East Flat Rock at 300 West King Street, just down the street from Case & Builder Supply. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturday, 8 till noon. Lewis Williams & Sons, 692-8216, or online at lewiswilliams.com. In business, relationships matter and trust must be earned. Duraline Imaging wants a chance to earn your trust and your business. Duraline is your single point of contact for office equipment sales, supplies, service, and repair. Duraline Imaging provides copier and printer sales and service solutions that lower cost, reduce waste, and simplify operations. Give Duraline a chance to earn your trust and your business. Give them a call today at 692-1301. Duraline Imaging, 692-1301.
And we are back with Lightning Thursdays, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com, Bill Moss, and of course brought to you by Fletcher Park Inn, Henderson County's best kept retirement secret. Bill, breaking news coming out this morning on the Lightning, Sam Neill has been released.
Yeah, just like everything else, only in the Lightning do you read that Sam Neill, the disbarred Hendersonville attorney that was well known in town and then sent to prison for embezzling from estates of deceased people that he had represented, is free after serving 6 years in federal and state prison.
Any idea what his future plans are?
No, Mr. Neal did not respond to a letter we sent to Cragg Correctional Center seeking an interview, and so far our efforts, aggressive as they are, to get an interview with Mr. Neal have not been successful.
Okay.
Emphasis on so far.
On so far, of course, absolutely. I know how you dog a story, Bill. let's talk about the 287G again. You've got an article here, big, long article, on page 7. Sheriff responds to 287G critics.
Yeah, there you go. This is it adds to, let's say, the body of knowledge in the public about what is known about 287G, how the sheriff carries it out. And the impetus for this, you might say, is not just on June 3rd, but most recently on Monday night, June 3rd, when the Board of County Commissioners was meeting to receive public comment and talk about and then ultimately adopt a 2020 budget. Lots of people showed up. Some on either side had been showing up over the last several weeks. There was a Tea Party driven campaign to present views very strongly in favor of continuing 287G program, which are only, I think, three counties remaining in the state that have a 287G memorandum of understanding, either two or three. I think it's three large metro counties, including Wake and Mecklenburg, had new sheriffs which dumped the 287G program. But one of the things critic, including the immigration attorney George Pappas, who does a lot of immigration work and is pretty vocal about his opinion that the 287G program is not even legal for reasons of the Fourth Amendment and so forth, said, well, the county commissions, you don't have any recent good figures at all from the sheriff about how many ICE detainers the sheriff is imposing. And so a few days after that, the sheriff and Ron Justice, his staff attorney, put together those statistics and a pretty decent explainer, we thought, and we devoted a lot of words to it and put a lot of their point of view, plus the point of view of Mr. Pappas and some of the opponents of 287G. You can read about it. It is, as you mentioned, a pretty long story that it covers both sides, as we like to try to do. It says what these 118 ICE detainers in the last 2 years, 17 and 18, what they were for. 83 involved charges of drunken driving, assaults, domestic violence, or drugs, and only 9 involved an arrest for traffic violations. And the reason they break out something regarded as much more minor, like a traffic violation, is they break that out in response to the criticism that you, the sheriff, are picking up people for a bad taillight, say, and then you're finding out that they're wanted by ICE and you're detaining them. And they're saying, no, that's not really true. One, we don't even do many traffic violations like that. And two, if we do a traffic violation, you don't end up in jail, usually, unless you're wanted on an actual crime. So their point is, no, these people were criminals, and we do pick up criminals. And if the ICE net catches them as wanted illegal residents or undocumented, if the ICE net catches them, well, so be it. And that the sheriff likes to say emphatically over and over is, we don't do roundups. People say, because we have this ICE agreement, that we're out in the apple orchards or we're on the roofing job or we're in the factory doing roundups. He says, no, we don't do that. And he says, if you don't do the crime, then you're not going to end up in jail, and the ICE net is not going to catch you to start with.
I'm glad you have this in here, and I'm looking forward to reading this, because I've heard proponents and I've heard the opponents, and I just haven't been able to figure it out myself, so I'm glad this is...
Yeah, you put your finger on the nose of why we devoted that much space to it. We thought it was really important that the sheriff had really responded directly to this challenge from Mr. Pappas that you have no numbers. You can't tell us what is going on with the ICE detainers. And he said, yes, I can, and here they are.
And here it is. Well, Let's get on to another great story here on page 8. The city signals detente in water war.
Yeah, we borrowed a kind of a Cold War headline term there, detente, or kind of a truce, really, in a long-running war over water. Who has it? Who charges for it? How much they charge? Who gets to say where it goes? Sewer to? Who gets to say where it goes? That drives a lot of development. And we, the county commissioners, think they really think the city has too much power because they control the water. Whether the rate equity issue is what they're really after, I think we will see. The county commission has been openly saying for a long time, and certainly with Commissioner Bill Lapsley, Commissioner Grady Hawkins has been real interested in it, certainly saying their preferred way to handle this utility and what it does and the decisions it makes and where it goes is through what a regional water authority really would be. It may not be regional, but it probably would just be a countywide water authority that in every county commission would have a lot of influence over.
Right.
So, I mean, you probably see something, I mean, let's say just blue sky in the thing, you might see something like three appointments by the city, three by the county.
Much like the TDA is, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing.
One each by Laurel Park, Flat Rock, Fletcher, and then some other random appointment. Maybe that make it a countywide representative body.
So I'm sure you say it in this story, but the truce that the city is offering is it okay we'll even the rates out for everybody? Is that their truce?
I did sort of bury the lead there. Yeah, the instant action on last Thursday night, that long meeting, the same night of the Gay Pride proclamation, was to direct City Manager John Connett to open this discussion, really, starting out at a staff level with County Manager Steve White. So we'll see where it goes from there. But that is it wasn't just direction to, go over there to the historic courthouse and talk to Steve about rates. It was to talk about rate equity.
So what we don't know right now yet is if county residents' water rates are going to go down or city's going to go up to make it.
The council said nothing. I'm just going to read from the story to address that point. The council said nothing that addressed the contours and time frame of rate equity. Given that 70% of the city's water customers live outside the city, a rate structure that dropped outside users' rates to the current city rate would generate far less revenue than the water sewer system needs. Because this operates as an enterprise fund, it is supposed to raise sufficient revenue to run the water system, to pay the salaries, to buy the trucks and to buy gasoline, and to pay the substantial debt service on all the borrowing they do for big things like big water extensions and plant upgrades.
Okay.
So a more likely scenario for rate equity would be to move city and county rates toward one another, likely over a number of years.
Okay. Got it. Mm-hmm. Got it. A couple of other great stories here before we leave. One of those is Maddie the Bloodhound was found. What a great story. What a great ending to that story.
Great ending the Lightning first heard about on WTZQ.
That's right. We had lots of callers who called in.
Yeah. And this was a happy ending to what could have been a sad ending of Maddie, the prize, the 2-year-old bloodhound show dog.
Yeah.
She got away, as sometimes we, all of us that have dogs, know, especially if you have a big, strong dog, they can jerk the leash out of your hand. And that's what happened to Maddie and Maddie's mom, Maddie's human. And she ran away from the Best Western. And the problem was she had that lead on her.
Yeah.
And I think she got stuck in the woods for quite some time. She got stuck. And this is not in the story, but what actually happened was she eventually, over some number of days, I think, chewed through that leash, and that's how she got away.
And got back.
And then she was found in this kind of, I think, I get the impression, in kind of an isolated, I mean, it was in someone's yard, but kind of isolated with a lot of no trespassing signs. And so if searchers which they were when they were searching for Maddie, they probably were prone not to go too much around where she was because
right.
Maddie was in the yard, and Maddie apparently did not read the no trespassing signs.
Yes.
But we even have a headshot, so get your
beautiful picture of Maddie.
We can't see it on the radio, but get your lightning and look on page 9 for a nice, beautiful headshot of Miss Maddie.
And you will also find on page 9 that the 2019 Apple Ambassador has been named.
An even better headshot of Ms. Katie Lynn Hart Ledbetter. This year's 2019 homeschooled student and also enrolled in Blue Ridge Community College in American Sign Language. This year's 2019 Apple Ambassador.
It's Lisa K. Bryant's birthday today. She just finished directing South Pacific, and there is a fantastic review for South Pacific right here in today's Hendersonville Lightning, or this week's.
There's a great review by our reviewer, Olivia Stuller. She's a 2009 graduate of Hendersonville High School. She's a Carolina woman. She's also a graduate of UNC at Chapel Hill and a past performer, at, I think, in the old youth theater and certainly in the did a terrific job. I remember her well in the senior play of 2009 at Hendersonville High School. So go check out that super fantastic, fun musical on the stage of Flat Rock Playhouse.
Running through July the 6th. You still have an opportunity to see it. Bill, we've just gotten behind the headlines. There's plenty more news in this week's Lightning. Where can people pick up their copy?
At any of the 60 Lightning Orange news racks all around Henderson County, or at any of our dealer partners, such as convenience stores or coffee shops, Hot Dog World, and the Publix supermarket, or by going to HendersonvilleLightning.com and clicking on that red tab that says, appropriately enough, subscribe, and following its directions to join the growing legions of Lightning fans that get their Lightning today, Lightning Thursday, or by calling Jan at 698-0407, or best of all, by coming to see us at 1111 Asheville Highway.
You've been listening to Lightning Thursday with Bill Moss, editor and publisher of Hendersonville Lightning and HendersonvilleLightning.com. This and other episodes of Lightning Thursday are available via podcast at WTZQ.com. Click on air and scroll down to Lightning Thursday. Lightning Thursday is brought to you weekly by Fletcher Park Inn, independent Christian retirement community, Fletcher Park Inn, Henderson County's best kept retirement secret.